praise the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good evening, everybody. It's nice, the lighting like this. It feels like we're in the living room. And if you want to kind of cozy, not too bright. So if you want to have a little snooze, go right ahead. Several of us were here on Saturday, and we had a really lovely all-day Zen sit, 6 in the morning until 9 at night. It's better not to add up how many hours that is, but in conventional time, it seems like a long time, and like, sort of conventional time is not necessarily your friend when you're approaching these things, because you could think to yourself, well, I can come on Wednesday night and I can sit for what's like a total of an hour and a bit, you know. But then my knee hurts a little bit, you know, so that's like 15 hours, so my knee would fall off, you know, right? Logical, you know. So it's better not to think about it that way. But actually, it's very beautiful, and what happens is, you sit for a while, conventional time is not quite as convincing. And you can enter into dream time. And one of the things I love the most about sitting all day is the way the light, you notice this, the way the light sort of gradually moves across the room, you know, from morning to night. And all this case is like dark, light, dark, you know. You know, one has one's moments, and sometimes it seems like it's dragging on and difficult, but other times it's just like so beautiful to watch the light and let the mind do what the mind needs to do. So this evening I thought I'd take a stab at saying something about the confusing Buddhist teaching of not-self or non-self. And so I'm calling this talk The Geometry of Self. I mentioned this at noon today, and Edie immediately said, but there is no self, which is exactly the point. So it's a good introduction. And we've all heard this, I think, but it's pretty confusing that Buddhism seems to be saying there's no self, no person. But I feel like a person. Don't you feel like a person? And the Buddhist teachings also seem to emphasize one's own direct experience, that you should not just sort of try to talk yourself into some dogma or some teaching, that the teachings may guide you or encourage you or provide you with some tools or new angles on things. But really, it's not real until you can see it for yourself and experience it for yourself. So On the face of it, this seems like not like it's going to really work out. Like, no self? I mean, it really feels like there's a self. I feel like somebody with an identity and a history and tendencies and wishes and desires and values and, you know, think of the vast vocabulary we've developed to describe this sort of thing that we call the self. But it turns out the Buddhist doctrine of non-self is not denying that experience. What it's saying is that we've come to some mistaken conclusions. These experiences and thoughts and emotions, which we pull together and impute this self from, is maybe not exactly the whole story, maybe not exactly real in the way that we think it is. And so the Buddhist teachings of non-self are saying there's a self and there's also not a self. And there's also not a self. So the Pali term is anatta, which literally means a means not, the prefix of a, and natta means is one of the words for self, so it means not self. So that's a pretty literal translation. And anatta is one of three, a set of three really fundamental teachings, fundamental concepts in Buddhism. The Buddha taught from the very beginning that not only do we not come to accurate conclusions about the nature of self, our conclusions about the sort of very nature of reality and experience are a little off. And the reason why they're a little off is that we're in some ways in denial or not really understanding in a direct way the sort of three fundamental aspects of reality. So he called these the three marks of reality, three marks of dharmas. And anatta is one of the three, this non-self. So now already we're hearing that this teaching of non-self doesn't just apply to what we call the self. Somehow it has a broader connotation. Something universal about reality is pointed to by this teaching of anatta, of not-self. And the other two are unsatisfactoriness, or the Pali word is dukkha, also gets translated as suffering, which is, and no translation of that word is in English is really quite satisfactory. It has many aspects and angles, but the essential point in this context is that we tend to seek lasting satisfaction from things that are not going to last, from things that are not really going to support that desire. And therefore, we're sort of serially disappointed, you know what I mean? And they often give, there's obvious examples from Western materialism, right, which we're kind of too hip for that, but we have to admit, if we look at it, we fall into that as well as anybody, right? If you only had fill in the blank, and then you get fill in the blank, and it's not quite what I thought. And there's a better one. And this drives the world economy too, right? So, you know, that's why they can sell the new iPods every year. And I guess here's a side point. A high percentage of iPod sales now are to people who already own one or more iPod. So it's like there's always a better one. So dukkha is the second one. This sort of, there's more angles to it, but for now, things not quite being satisfactory or satisfying in the way that we think they should be. They're deeply satisfying in ways beyond this, but for now, dukkha. And then the third of the three marks is anicca, which means impermanence. So anatta, dukkha, and anicca. And I don't really think that to practice you have to learn and memorize lots of terms in five different languages, but these three would be good to learn because the English translations, even when they're pretty straightforward and literal, like not-self or non-self, have so many other connotations that they sort of confuse us and we kind of miss the boat. So it's not the worst to learn these three terms, anatta, dukkha, anicca. And I, one of the things I appreciate about anicca, about impermanence, is that it's so obvious, you know what I mean? And it seems like, why would he even bother to say that, you know? It's like everyone knows that everything's impermanent. But if you think about our attitude towards impermanence, we don't really quite believe in it. And the way we tend to be, if you notice, is things are permanent for a little while, at least. Then they're impermanent. So we basically, include impermanence in the concept of later. We don't really believe in impermanence right now, and which is part of why death is so hard. And by the way, another aside to the aside, I had put another name on the altar. Elfrieda Goetz is Margie Goetz's mom, who died on Saturday. And she was in her middle 90s and had been ill. And Margie told me today that they got together at Thanksgiving and her mom was lucid and they had a nice time. And her mom more or less said, "This is wonderful, now I can let go." So it's like a very sort of classic, you know, it's like the kind of death we like, as much as we can like death. So it's so interesting, isn't it, our way we're wanting to have things in just certain ways. But anyway, so back to anatta. Now, what we got to remember about all these things is that the Buddha was not just trying to be clever. His central point is always freedom from suffering. It's always liberation. Always being freed up from the ways that we're caught and bound. And he was only interested in trying to analyze and understand reality to the extent that it served that purpose of freedom and liberation. And so there's some lovely, well-known passages in the Pali Canon where people show up and ask him abstruse philosophical questions, and he won't answer those kind of questions. Like, is the nature of the universe permanent? He wouldn't answer, you know, that kind of thing. So we should always consider when we hear Buddhist teaching and it doesn't really sort of make sense or it seems really philosophical or abstract, the way to approach it is to wonder, well, how could this be helpful? Let's start, you know, one starts from the assumption this must be helpful in some way, you know. Maybe I don't understand it, or maybe, you know, I'm not ready for it, or maybe it just doesn't have to be helpful to me, I don't know, but let's start from there. And so this teaching on non-self must have some liberating quality. So I want to tell you a story from another sesshin. And let me tell you a little more background on sesshin if you haven't had that experience. To sit all day is not just about packing in a lot of meditation. We practice quiet during the day, so there's no conversation. The schedule and arrangements allow us to reduce our decision-making quite radically. Well, still, strangely, the mind has all these funny little ways of finding little decisions to make, even though there aren't any you have to make. But, you know, should I stretch like this, like that? You know, there's always something. But anyway, radically reduces decision-making and sort of creates a container in which the whole life, your whole life and your whole being can sort of settle a little bit, or a lot bit. And it can be quite peaceful, and it can also be quite intense, because if the mind is strongly conditioned, as ours tend to be, to want sort of constant trouble, you know, and stimulation and excitement, and then you tell your mind, okay, for the next one day or 3 days or 7 days, you know, the big excitement is going to be a bell ringing. And that can be pretty exciting, you know, actually. You know, or, you know, whether it's going to be lentil soup or miso soup, you know. Or maybe that nice Mexican chili. And so in this context, you can see things about the mind that you kind of know, but you don't pay a whole lot of attention to because you're busy going on to the next thing. busy going to work, busy going to school, busy taking care of your family, busy recreating, busy doing whatever you're doing. And there's a sort of tremendous sense in this practice of Sesshin of the possibility for really radical insight and discovery. And there's also a kind of unmooring and sort of disconnection from the usual things that hold us in our usual place. So it can also be confusing and even disturbing. But fundamentally, you're not doing much of anything. So it's really interesting to think about how could an experience of doing basically nothing have all these different aspects, but it does. And one of the things that I've often noticed in Sesshin is that when we remove this sort of steady social stimulus of reassurance, a lot can happen in the mind and in the heart. That part of what we're doing socially all the time is reassuring each other that we're okay. That a good percentage of our social interactions have that quality. Which is why it's a little bit unnerving, I think, to meet somebody new, especially somebody that you somehow feel some attraction to. Because you don't know if they're going to reassure you or not. And there's this little moment of, uh-oh, you know. And we do have a way to sort of saying, "Hi, I'm Tim, would you please reassure me that I'm okay?" And if you do, I will definitely reassure you that you're okay. So all this is taken away in Sesshin, and it becomes more possible, therefore, to be more aware of the actual patterns of thinking and emotion and feelings in the mind and the body. Some of which are not, from that point of view, okay. There's a tremendous amount of support in the practice of Sesshin in a healthy community. So there is a lot of support, but not that kind of mutually limiting reassurance support. There's a sort of emptiness support, a support in which we're giving each other radically space to be whoever we actually need to be right now, not who we think we need to be right now. And in that context, sometimes you figure out that you don't know yourself quite as well as you thought you did. And you can see ways in which that not knowing and confusion and that sort of disconnect can allow you to get way off the track of reality. Like one of my favorites is you could be sitting Sesshin with somebody whom you hadn't met before, maybe sitting right next to them. And there's a way that you really get to know them, you know what I mean? You know the way they walk, you know the way they sit, you know? Maybe you know the way they smell a little bit. you know them in a way, you know, that you don't know a lot of people, you know, this person sitting next to you at the Sesshin, at the Zen retreat. And naturally, the mind then starts imputing from that a self. So here's another way of studying not self. You're creating for that person a self, because you don't know their story. You don't know where they're from or what their job is or whether they like you or any of that stuff. And it's possible to make up a very elaborate and convincing story. And then at the end of the retreat, you seek them out, you know, to say hello and tell them that you know their story. Yeah, basically. And like the first word out of their mouth, it all just like crumbles in the dust. And you realize, I made all that up, you know. And so Sesshin can help us see how convincing this story of self is. And if we are telling that story about other people and believing it, in what ways are we doing that about for ourselves? all the time. But it's so convincing. And when we make up a story about who we are, there's not another, usually another one of us inside us to have that conversation and realize it was all made up. And one of the things that I often notice in Sesshin practice is that tendencies I have normally within the quiet context of Sesshin are really like loom large, you know what I mean? Like one of the things that happens in our normal sort of socially reassured world is that one of the things that we're doing there is we're putting our tendencies always sort of back in perspective, back in perspective, back in perspective, you know. You know, I got a little grumpy, but she was a little grumpy, and it's okay, you know. And one of my own tendencies, maybe you've noticed, is my personality, I seem to have a tendency to become sort of overly involved in things. Sort of doing a little bit too much. A little bit leaning into life a little more than is quite healthy for me or for others, you know. Not too much anymore, but a little bit. I often do that. Not giving people quite enough space to figure things out for themselves, you know. Running around organizing things a little too much. And some people love that, and some people don't like that, but it's a tendency that I have. And I'm always studying and working with and noticing when it creates suffering. And when I create suffering in somebody else, practicing apologizing and starting over. And it's something I work with, and it doesn't upset me too much anymore, usually. But I've noticed in Sesshin that I really focus on that tendency for some reason. Partly because a lot of the Sesshin, I am one of the organizers. So there are a lot of things I need to be doing. And so there's sort of like a lot of opportunities to like do a little too much or give somebody a little too much support or a little too many suggestions or go on a little too much or just not be quiet, you know, give people space. And so that's why it's really great for me to go to other sanghas, retreats. I'm getting to a point here. Don't worry. Hopefully it'll be helpful. And so I went to this retreat in Canada. 7-day retreat in Canada not too long ago, where I didn't really have any responsibilities. They had it all organized. I didn't have to figure out who was going to do which jobs and be the smart one who knew all this stuff. I could just go sit. And I especially did not want to interfere with their process, you know. In the sort of context of our sanghas, you know, I know that I can cast a long shadow, so I was really trying to be quiet. Like, I was really, like, I thought of it before the sesshin, which I don't usually, I'm like, okay, I'm going to work on this, you know. It's a little problematic in Sesshin to work on things, but I did. I wanted to work on this. And I was doing pretty well, I thought, at first. But then, like, there's all these little impulses to, like, help out and give somebody a little tip, you know. Like, we were doing Orioki practice like we did here on Saturday, and, you know, there were several people next to me who hadn't done Orioki before, you know, and so I tried to go a little slower and make sure my movements were obvious. That was okay, you know. But then I noticed my neighbor was just not getting the thing, and I was like, every meal, like, should I say something? He was taking his napkin and just kind of putting it aside and not spreading it out, you know. And I was like, I know this is not that important, and he's just having a machine. So, and then, you know, I didn't say anything. But, you know, it was a big sort of, it was becoming this big theme, you know, in the mind, you know, this big theme of like, no. You know. It's best to close my eyes during the meals. So I wouldn't see all the mistakes, you know. And then I was in there's not too many spaces in that facility to like relax, or in my case I was sewing, doing some Zen sewing. So there's only sort of one place where you could do Zen sewing, which also happened to be the only place you could really have a meeting. And so the organizers were having a meeting after lunch. And I asked, you know, I was very careful. I said, oh, should I leave? And they said, no, please stay, please stay. You won't bother us. So then I'm sitting there sewing, listening to this meeting, which is like the exact same meeting I've had, you know, 100 times, you know, trying not to say anything. And anyway, it went on like that. And one of the things that they did ask me to do was to give practice discussion where people could come see me individually to discuss their practice, which is lovely. And not that many of them knew me, so I didn't like have a whole lot of business, so I just saw a few people and it was very nice. And so I thought I was doing okay. And then I was looking at the little sheet where people write down if they want to see you, and I saw on there that Kate McCandless, one of the priests, you know, like the main organizer, in this case, the head organizer, like we're trying to clarify our roles, and we're using a role we haven't used before called the Tanto, the head of practice. So Kate is the head of practice, you know, the top dog, you know. And she signed up to see me, and I had an intense panic attack because I immediately came to an absolutely compelling conclusion that she had signed up to talk to me individually so she could chew me out for my endless meddling ways, my constant interference, and how, you know. And then it was like very intense, and then I'm like, whoa, you know, internally. And then I thought, well, what is that, you know? Oh, why am I feeling this way? And then, well, you know, why am I thinking that, you know? And I wasn't quite sure if it was real or not, but I had enough space, you know, of several days of sitting to sort of think, wow, what is that? What's under that, I wondered. And then I saw fear, you know, really powerful fear under that. And what I realized the fear seemed to be about was the fear that I am crippled in a certain way, that I have a certain personality which is never going to allow true intimacy with others. But this tendency, you know, this particular tendency, which I was like studying, like in a microscope, you know. And when you look at a microscope, things get big, right? You know, it's just going to prevent that, and it's really strong fear. And then I had this kind of realization, which is getting to not self, that our personality is a kind of a shape, a kind of a geometric shape almost, you know, which has formed over many years, you know, a little bit because of our choices or our input, but largely through many other factors, you know, the way we were brought up, our society, our culture, you know, maybe previous lives, maybe, if you're going for that kind of thing. And that our personality is like this geometrical shape that's been created with all these different, in all these different ways, and that it's something that we carry around because that's what human beings do. It's how we function in the world. We can't sort of, it would be sort of impossible and probably really unhealthy to try to like get rid of this shape. But that this shape, and the shape has little sort of pokey places that stick out, you know? And sometimes your pokey places might bump into somebody else's pokey places. But that's not you either. That's just sort of a corner, you know, a sharp corner or a... I keep picturing these little sort of tendrils or something coming out of this thing. The visualization is just shifting. You know? And I had a really powerful feeling of, just in an instant, of I don't have to be afraid for my shape. My shape is my responsibility. Nobody else has this shape, this particular shape. I need to work with it to reduce trouble. But I can really let go of that strong identification with personality. And of course, you know, a few minutes later it all comes rushing back, but that's, I think, a little bit what the Buddha was trying to talk about. And you may, through practice, come to see this complex of thinking and emotion and personality and whatever else, you know, the vast literature of pop psychology and real psychology and all this, you know, we have many different tools and ways of looking at this, all of which are just concepts, right? None of them are exactly it. And so your personality might never look, may never look like a geometric shape to you. It really did. I could, like, see it for a second. It was kind of like sort of a prism, kind of. And but in the quiet of meditation and with the mind prepared a little bit, I think, aware of the possibility that these thoughts, this personality, you know, these tendencies are not me in that solid, stuck way that I think sometimes think that they are. And in that, there's a little space and a little bit of liberation. Because the other thing about it is that it's like a vicious cycle too, right? One has certain tendencies. One gets worried about having certain tendencies. One gets afraid about having certain tendencies. And the tendencies get more intense, you know what I mean? And I could really see the way I was doing that. And of course, by the way, when Kate came to see me, it was nothing to do with me. She wanted to talk about her own problems. her own shape was giving her trouble. So it's a little bit like the story of the sixth ancestor, to bring it back to Zen. Do you know the story of the sixth ancestor? So supposedly in China, long ago, long, long time ago, there was a monastery, a Zen monastery, and with an important teacher, like one of the most famous teachers in northern China, and, you know, pretty big community. And there was a head monk in the community who was the sort of obvious successor. And along comes this other fellow, and the head monk, I always forget his name, I think I put it down here. Lost track of it. Anyway, forget the, oh, here it is. The head monk's name, I forgot to write down the teacher's name, which I've forgotten too, but the head monk's name was Shen Xu. So Shen Xu was a very smart guy, you know, very hardworking, very upright and outstanding, and, you know, probably immaculate, probably his robes were carefully tended and did everything right. We all know somebody like this, right? Head of the class. And this other guy came along named Wei Ning. And Wei Ning was not that way. He was kind of a rough sort of character, grew up in poverty, and sort of got interested in practice kind of by accident, and was illiterate. Didn't have school where he was growing up. And when he showed up, they sent him to work in the kitchen, you know, as you would do, right? And so one time the teacher of the monastery said, supposedly, that he was ready to decide who he would be his successor. You know, this is all sort of predicated on the wonderful Zen myth of a linear, ancestral lineage, you know, one teacher, one student, and it goes along like that. And so he announced like a poetry contest to clarify who really understood Zen and who would be his worthy successor. And of course, everybody assumed that the head monk, Shen Xu, would be the one. And of course, Shen Xu, you know, humbly waiting a little while, was then the first one to write his poem on the wall or something. And here's his poem. So this is like how we usually think about ourselves. This is his understanding of Dharma. And this is true as far as it goes. The body is a Bodhi tree. The mind is a standing mirror, bright. At all times, polish it diligently and let no dust alight. The body is a Bodhi tree. The mind is a standing mirror, bright. At all times, polish it diligently, and let no dust alight. So take care of everything very carefully. You know, go to therapy, clean up your problems, you know, clean up your house. Do everything just so, you know. Take care of this self. Polish it up. You want your shape to be a beautiful, smooth, like shiny, like egg or something like that. So that was his understanding. And that's kind of what we all think, right? If I just try hard enough, if I just polish the mirror, if I could just improve, we might be a little discouraged. We might not have as much confidence as Xin Shui. We might not really think we can do this, but we basically think that that's how it goes. And so the rough character, Wei Ning, hearing this, knew in a flash that was not how it is. He could just somehow see the other side of that, see the emptiness to that. And he had to have one of his buddies in the kitchen write this out for him on the wall, you know, because he couldn't write. And so his response was, Bodhi is no tree, nor is the mind a standing mirror bright. Since all is originally empty, where does the dust alight? Where does the dust alight? Yeah. Bodhi is not a no tree. The mind, nor is the mind a standing mirror bright. Since all is originally empty, where does the dust alight? So, are our problems really problems? Where are your problems? Are they in here or over here? In here? What are they sticking to? Can the dust really land anywhere? And so, of course, we need both poems, which is the point of the story. Sometimes the story is misunderstood to be like, the first guy was a big, you know, loser, and he didn't get it, and you know, he tried too hard, and too bad for him, you know. And the second guy was like, but you need both, you know. It's both two halves of one coin. We need to take care of this self and realize there's no self here. There's no self to take care of. It's all just fill in the blank. No words are right. So anyway, I hope this was in some way helpful. I wanted to share with you a little bit about that, my experience of anatta, in hopes that it will encourage you to study this. And not just with your thinking, but with your heart, with your body, with your senses. But also to consider in our thinking, how do we think about ourselves? Is that way of thinking about ourselves accurate? And more importantly, does that way of thinking about ourselves bring us joy? Or does it create suffering? And in Western culture, we're quite concerned about what's right and what's wrong. And I think it might be more helpful for us to de-emphasize that particular duality in our life, and maybe we can help our culture that way. Is it really that helpful to worry about what's right? What did it feel like the last time you tried hard to be right? Or the last time you were really upset about being wrong? Are those helpful concepts? And so we're so lucky that we have this practice handed down to us, which can create, you know, a container, a space, some tools that we would never would have thought of on our own. You know, who would have thought of doing Zen? So that was my first topic, and I want to read to you a little bit, a little bedtime story. And please don't take my story too literally. Please don't be doing meditation to try to see your shape. Because it won't be that for you. You know what I mean? Or it wasn't that for you. And the other thing about these kind of realizations is not to think that you aren't having a realization all the time. We're always realizing the nature of reality. It's just we usually don't notice. So please also don't misunderstand us and think that I'm like a super meditator and I figured something out that you couldn't have figured out. You already figured this out. But maybe you didn't notice. Or maybe you forgot. And I luckily had to give a talk, so it forced me to think about it. Remember. I'm going to read you a little bit from Ajahn Amaro. That book I've really been appreciating. He's an English, born in England, and he's a Theravadan monk in the Thai forest tradition. So the guys that have the sort of orangey robes with one shoulder bare and follow the longer list of rules for monks. And he studied in, I won't give it away. Here's what he said about his early studies, and it touches a little bit on what I was saying. But I was just so appreciating his story and the way he explains the teachings. And I think I have time to do this with you. Yes, we do. Everybody doing okay? Okay, good. He says, and the other thing that's neat about this particular book, which is called, I don't know why it's called this, but it's called Small Boat, Great Mountain, is there talks from a retreat that he co-led with a Tibetan Dzogchen teacher. So seemingly different ends of the Buddhist spectrum. So they were interested to look at sort of commonalities. And so I think it kind of gives his teachings a sort of extra clarity because he's not like trying to figure out how his stuff's like Tibet or not like Tibet, but I think the way he was teaching was sort of all the more clear in that context. So first he introduces himself. Probably like many people, I wrestled at length with the question of freedom in my teens and early 20s. I was a late flower child, having been born in 1956. I just caught the tail end of the good stuff. And through most of my early years, I worshipped the idea of freedom and longed for the true experience of it. Rather than becoming a bomb-throwing anarchist, though, I became more of a flower-waving philosophical anarchist. Nevertheless, I took this aspiration to freedom very seriously, and I had a profound intuition that freedom is possible. And there is this potential we have as human beings to be totally free, and that there's something utterly pure, uninhibited, and uninhibitable within us. Uninhibitable. My experience, however, was one of colliding with endless restrictions and frustrations. First it was getting away from my parents. Then it was the law. Then it was not having enough money. I thought that this or that was standing in the way of freedom. And if only it wasn't there, I would then be free. And I was completely bewildered. No matter how much I tried to be free and unhindered by conventions, forms, and structures, mostly by defying these things, there always seemed to be another layer and another layer and another layer. I kept meeting up with limitations. And as a result, I was constantly feeling frustrated. I was suffering. And I really had no idea why. I left England and began my travels in hopes of finding freedom somewhere. Anywhere. I went to Southeast Asia and pursued a Dionysian lifestyle of eat, drink, be merry, sex, drugs, rock and roll, dancing in the moonlight on the beaches. And I think there were certain beaches in Thailand in the 70s where that's all that was happening. You know? With one hand waving free. But inside, that one hand waving free, what was the other hand doing? It doesn't say. But inside me was a feeling that I was coming to a desperate crunch, to the end of the line. I knew intuitively that this decadent path really was not leading to freedom. So I searched some more. I took off to northeast of Thailand, where hardly any Western tourists ever went, and found myself wandering into a forest monastery. It was a branch of Ajahn Chah's monastery, where his Western monks lived. It's important to know that the Thai forest tradition is the stiff end of an already narrow orthodoxy. It's a very strict observance of an already conservative tradition. And this was immediately apparent to me. But what was immediately apparent to me, however, was that these people were living the most bizarrely austere life, yet they also were very cheerful. They were the most cheerful characters I've ever met. And here they were, getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, eating one meal a day, drinking a cup of tea twice a week, sleeping on thin grass mats, having no sex, definitely no sex, no drugs, no alcohol, and no rock and roll. And yet they were fully at ease, very friendly, and uncomplicated people. And I asked myself, what have they got to laugh about? How come they're so happy when their lifestyle is so restricted? And then I met Ajahn Chah, the teacher. If I thought the monks seemed pretty content with their lot, meeting him was even more striking. Ajahn Chah appeared to be the happiest man in the world. He'd been living as a monk in the forest without any sex, music, or drink for 40 years. You would imagine someone would be pretty dried up by then. But here was a man who was totally at ease with life. In fact, he was thoroughly enjoying it, totally content. The Thank you, John. Thank you very much. It's only a little bit. They did warn us not to put water on the floor. Now, the monastery routine was extremely restrained. Oh, got something going on here. It aimed at simplifying all the externals. So it's like sashin, see? All the externals, so one could put one's attention directly and pointedly on the one place where one can find freedom, in the inner world. So rather than monastery life being a negation of the sense world, or criticism, hatred, or fear of it, the whole lifestyle was built around simplicity of living. It was the monk's job to place the attention on the inner dimension, where one could be totally free. I was so taken by this way of being that, to my amazement, I found myself staying. When I showed up, I figured I'd never stay more than 3 days. And I didn't stay until later, but I think I ended up staying for 3 years or something like that. I quickly realized that I had been looking for freedom in the wrong place. I remember opening up to myself and chuckling. How could I have been so stupid? It never crossed my mind that freedom could come only from within. Until then, I had been looking for freedom in what was inherently bound. My misguided way of finding freedom was by defying conventions, by trying not to be inhibited by the rules of society or the dictates of my personality or the conditioning of my body. I appeared free on the outside, but on the inside I was a prisoner to my beliefs and behaviors and to his idea of self. It was only by turning my attention inward that I could discover the freedom that was already there. I realized that these external forms and structures that we pick up and use, for example, retreat routines and schedules, and the language and jargon of Buddhism, and different meditation retreats, these are designed to help us direct our attention to where we are totally free. It is not like we need to become free. It is a matter of discovering that quality of being that is inherently unhindered and unbound. Another one I was going to read, but maybe that's enough. So I recommend Amaro. So the name on the book here is Amaro Bhikkhu, and then sometimes it's Ajahn Amaro, I think.
What's the title again?
Small Boat, Great Mountain. Small Boat, Great Mountain. And these guys, Thai Forest Order and the American descendants are famous for giving away books for free. So if we write them, they'll give us free books. So. Yeah, pass it around if you're interested. Doesn't have a picture of him or anything like that. But so, do you have any comment or question? Or?
I have a comment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
did you? Oh, nice.
And it's really interesting to hear that. I didn't know anything about his background, yeah. But he was very amused by life, you know, yeah. Full of energy, uh-huh. Very amused, and, yeah. And for his age, very I wouldn't say wise, but just full of experience, you know, in life and acceptance of life. And I can see from reading that, hearing mm-hmm. that passage, that that might have been true. He's really a great guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I got a phone call from, and he has some connections with Zen, too. He visits San Francisco Zen Center. I got a phone call from Robin Orden, who's at Tassajara during the practice period, just finishing now. And she told me that he had visited there and they'd had a lovely teaching with him. And he's somebody who has a broad appreciation for Dharma, yeah. And it's really... It's a clear way of expressing it, too, so it's nice. But he goes on to just, he doesn't talk about himself much more after that. He just goes on to teach about Dharma. Anything else up, or should we just close? That would be fine too.